And then the only other time we could take off is our paid time that we had to earn the previous year.
Yeah, that does seem ridiculous. They would never let airline pilots do that.
No, they wouldn't. And thanks for noticing, Newsmax.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM, people-powered radio in L.A. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding, on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast, on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, in Concord, New Hampshire, where it's going to be a hell of an election year, on WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, in Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk, fine affiliates all, just to name a few, by the way. Blanketing Planet Earth, 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another all-too-thrilling edition of the Bradcast.
Oh, I don't know if you can be too thrilling.
We'll see. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
As the nation braces now for what could be a crippling railway workers' strike, more on that shortly, the great Harold Meyerson of the American Prospect will join us momentarily to discuss a huge win for labor, specifically for some 550,000 fast food workers out here in California that was sealed last week by the state's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom. But before we get to all of that, very quickly, the final primary elections of the midterm season were held on Tuesday in Delaware, Rhode Island, and New Hampshire, with the critical midterm elections now less than 8 weeks away.
Oh, boy.
By the way, if you haven't checked to make sure you're still registered, still on the rolls, have not been thrown off of them, now is a really good time to do that.
Indeed it is, because it does happen.
Yes, it does. We've discussed in detail on yesterday's Bradcast the terrible voting systems forced on voters in Delaware, the marginally better hand-marked paper ballot systems used in Rhode Island, and the even better hand-marked paper ballot system used in New Hampshire, where about 40% of the towns employ democracy's gold standard of hand counting those hand-marked paper ballots at the precinct in public on election night before ballots are moved anywhere. If you missed that program, you can download it, of course, for free at bradblog.com. As to the known results of noteworthy races in those three states today, even as most of the computer tallied ballots, other than the hand counted ones in New Hampshire, remain completely unverified by actual human beings today, let's run through just a few of the noteworthy contests, most of which have to do with how Trumpy the GOP candidates chosen by Republican voters actually are. Let's start in Delaware, in any event, since it's the easiest, with just one single statewide contested election and no contested House or Senate races. In this case, the contested race was for state auditor on the Democratic side, where the party avoided a bit of a disaster, according to Washington Post Dave Weigel, by defeating state auditor, Democratic state auditor, Kathy McGinnis. She won in 2018, but then she got convicted on three misdemeanor corruption charges.
Oh, hello.
but was running again anyway. She appears to have been soundly defeated by a more than 2-1 margin by Lydia York, who received the party's endorsement as well in Delaware. Meanwhile, in Rhode Island, Governor Dan McKee, who had been the lieutenant governor until he replaced Governor Gina Raimondo, who left the job to become Joe Biden's Secretary of Commerce, Daniel, appears to have fended off several Democratic challengers, one of them fairly narrowly, to become the winner of the Democratic nomination for a full term as governor in Rhode Island. He is expected to coast to victory in November in the very Democratic-leaning state against Republican challenger Ashley Kallas, who easily won the GOP nomination on Tuesday. The most interesting and/or contested races of the night were in the great state of New Hampshire, where the disgraced former president declared on his social media website, quote, "Nice, the Trumpiest people all won in New Hampshire last night." And while I don't know for sure, I think there are actually many Democrats who are likely to agree with him on that, especially when it comes to the U.S. Senate race and what Republicans had expected to be a very flippable seat currently held by Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan, who won the seat 6 years ago by the barest of margins, just 1,017 votes out of about 700,000 cast. At the time, she unseated the Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte. Well, this time, the race for that Senate seat is probably not going to be quite as close, but we will see. Retired Army Brigadier General Donald Bolduc appears to have narrowly won New Hampshire's Senate Republican primary on Tuesday, setting up another test of whether a far-right conspiracy theorist and election denier can appeal to more moderate general election voters in the fall. If the numbers hold, Bolduc will have defeated New Hampshire Senate President Chuck Morse and the establishment Republicans who tried to stifle Bolduc's ascendancy, fearing that he's too extreme to win a general election. Morse conceded early Wednesday morning, though ballots are still being counted. It was a pretty close race. In the final weeks of the campaign, a PAC linked to an ally of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell dumped $4 million into the race in hopes of boosting Morse, but it looks like Mitch lost again. Neither candidate benefited this time around from Trump's endorsement because he didn't give out one. Both tried to get it. Bolduc, who has suggested the FBI may need to be abolished and has called for the 17th Amendment to be abolished as well. That's the direct election of senators by the people. He attracted attention for calling New Hampshire's Republican Governor Chris Sununu, who is a moderate by today's party standards. He called him, quote, a Chinese communist sympathizer.
Oh, dear.
He also attracted attention for falsely claiming that Trump was the winner of the 2020 presidential election. Sununu said about Bolduc on a New Hampshire radio station, quote, he's not a serious candidate, and if he were the GOP nominee, I have no doubt we would have a much harder time, adding politely, he's kind of a conspiracy theorist type candidate. Well, that conspiracy theorist type candidate appears to have won the GOP nomination and will now face Democratic incumbent Senator Maggie Hassan, who easily won her primary on Tuesday, further eroding GOP hopes of winning back the majority in the upper chamber of Congress in November. But we will see. Two other pro-Trump candidates won their U.S. House primaries in New Hampshire. Carolyn Leavitt in the 1st Congressional District and Bob Burns in the 2nd of the state's two congressional districts, leaving some in the party questioning whether they will be able to broaden their appeal beyond the GOP base come November. Both House seats are currently occupied by Democrats, but Republicans have been bullish about chances of flipping one or both of them. Major changes in the state's two congressional districts were expected this year thanks to the once-a-decade redistricting process, but that did not happen. Earlier this year, the Republican-controlled state legislature redrew those two districts to give the GOP an advantage. But Sununu, who easily won his own primary, by the way, for a fourth term on Tuesday, a fourth two-year term, he will run against Democrat Tom Sherman, who ran unopposed. Sununu vetoed the redistricting plan, and the maps were then updated by the courts with very few changes. New Hampshire's first district flipped five different times in seven elections before Democratic Congressman Chris Pappas won his first term in 2018. He faced no primary opponents this year, while more than 10 Republicans vied for the chance to challenge him. The race largely came down to two Trump acolytes who sort of beat the hell out of each other during the campaign as to which of the two was the Trumpiest. And there was actually an upset in this race. Caroline Leavitt, a 25-year-old hard right Republican who served as an assistant in Trump's White House press office, won the party's primary nomination on Tuesday. The race had devolved into a very nasty battle with Matt Maurer, a former Trump administration colleague, over who carried the mantle of Trumpism. If Leavitt wins in November against Democratic Congressman Pappas, she would be among the youngest people ever elected to Congress. The Constitution actually requires House members to be at least 25 years old to serve. Leavitt just turned 25 last month. So she appears to have defeated the 33-year-old Maurer, who served in Trump's State Department and on his 2016 campaign. He entered the race a year ago, presumed to be the front runner. He benefited from a whole bunch of cash, more than $1 million from an outside PAC aligned with Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. As the Times describes Leavitt, she adopted Trump's brash style and taste for inflammatory statements and was backed by a host of hard right Republicans in Congress. In her campaign, Leavitt unequivocally repeated Trump's lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. And having looked at a whole bunch of her campaign ads last night, I'll tell you what, if she wins in November, I think the party will have itself another Marjorie Taylor Greene to contend with.
Oh, boy.
But a smarter one. Here's one of Leavitt's ads, just to give you an idea.
The modern-day Democrat Party is hell-bent on driving America into socialism. We will not allow them to win any longer. I was proud to work in President Trump's White House, where we fought against the fake news and the political elites on the front lines every single day. We need to ensure border security. We need to ban critical race theory. We need to balance the checkbook of Washington. That's why I'm running, to put New Hampshire first, to put America first.
Caroline Leavitt for Congress.
I'm Caroline Leavitt, and I approve this message.
So you get the idea. She enters the general election, however, somewhat bruised by the bitter primary with Maurer's campaign, which operated a website branding her, quote, fake MAGA Caroline, accusing her of, quote, never holding a real job outside the swamp. She was also registered to vote from her, quote, penthouse apartment in D.C., where she lived before moving back to New Hampshire to run for office. Leavitt, however, pushed back hard, like in this campaign ad targeting Maurer, who served as chief of staff to Dr. Deborah Birx, who had headed up Trump's so-called COVID task force.
No one's worked harder to sabotage President Trump than Deborah Birx. And Matt Maurer stood with Birx while she was hiding crucial information from President Trump during the pandemic. It's no surprise Matt Maurer served as Birx's chief of staff, even calling her a national treasure. All the while, Birx was forcing unconstitutional COVID lockdowns on us, destroying New Hampshire's economy and killing local jobs. Matt Maurer stands with his anti-Trump liberal friends, not New Hampshire.
Wow. That's some insanity right there.
You think? So that's from Leavitt. You get the idea. It should be a fun 8 weeks between now and November 8 in New Hampshire. And frankly, whether she wins or loses, I am predicting right now that Leavitt will be a new GOP star. Pappas, for his part, wasted little time going on the offensive against Leavitt on Wednesday, saying, quote, I will fight with everything I've got to stop extreme politicians like Caroline from hijacking our democracy. In the second congressional district in New Hampshire, the pro-Trump Robert Burns narrowly won the Republican nomination in a seven-way race to face five-term incumbent Democrat Congresswoman Annie Custer in a general election race that the GOP sees as potentially very competitive. We shall see. As always, none of those races are yet certified, and sometimes tabulation problems reveal themselves in the days or even weeks after Election Day. So if there are any changes, of course, or questions, we will let you know. Let's take a quick break here and a sharp left turn, if you will, to discuss some labor issues and an impending railway strike that could throw sand into all of the midterm election year gears. I warned you these were unconventional times. So, yeah, continue to ignore all of the so-called conventional wisdom between here and November. We'll also be joined by Harold Meyerson ahead as well. Another crazy day on the broadcast. Just like all the other days these days, I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
Hey, this is Desi. The Bradcast and the Green News Report survive thanks to you and your support. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate today to help us stay independent every day over your public airwaves. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
We got to work together. Work, work together.
Yes, please.
Come on, people got to work together.
Let's try, shall we? Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Transit systems across the country were on edge on Wednesday amid the threat of a freight rail worker strike, making preparations ahead of possible travel disruptions that could affect hundreds of thousands of rail customers. Amtrak said Wednesday afternoon it is canceling all long-distance trains starting Thursday. Some regional transit agencies said they are preparing for service stoppages as early as Thursday evening ahead of a possible 12:01 a.m. Friday shutdown. The disruptions to passenger systems that operate on freight lines would be felt across several major metropolitan areas, including Washington, Chicago, out here in Los Angeles. The strike threat also eliminated most Amtrak service outside the Northeast Corridor, forcing travelers to find other modes of transportation or cancel plans at the last minute. The Biden administration has sought to resolve the labor conflict to avert the possibility of one of the most disruptive strikes in recent U.S. history. The Association of American Railroads estimates a shutdown could cost the economy more than $2 billion a day and, quote, could idle more than 7,000 trains daily and trigger retail product shortages, widespread manufacturing shutdowns, job losses, and disruptions to hundreds of thousands of passenger rail customers. Well, that's just about all that we need right now, ain't it? The Washington Post's Jeff Stein notes that, quote, even though the deadline for reaching a deal is midnight on Thursday, the threat of a strike could affect things even before that. Industry groups are saying we could see grain shipments on trains stopping as early as Thursday morning. To which the American Prospect's David Dayan noted this, quote, deliberate stoppage of various shipments by the companies looks more like a lockout than a strike. A railroad worker strike that would shut down much of the major transportation infrastructure in the U.S. is now looming. A stoppage, whoever stops it first, is one which could impact nearly every part of the economy, from food to energy to retail. But as the Prospect's labor reporter Mike Elk notes, the main issues are not wages, but time off from work. The impasse, he explains, is tied to disagreements between management and labor over sick time and penalties for missing work. Two of the nation's largest rail carriers, Union Pacific and BNSF, a subsidiary of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, have attendance policies that penalize workers, including firing for going to routine doctor visits or attending to family emergencies. As former Labor Secretary Robert Reich noted on Twitter today, the Warren Buffett-owned railway BNSF tracks time off with points. Missing a single day for something like a doctor's visit can result in workers losing points. Run out of points, and you can be fired. Is it any wonder, he asks, why 57,000 railroad workers are planning to strike? Elk reports that railroads have found themselves under capacity to deal with an uptick in demand for goods during the pandemic, thanks to years of deliberate understaffing to maximize profits. Critics claim that the scheduling policies are all an attempt to squeeze as much out of existing workers as possible, rather than, you know, hire new ones. And as the railroads have laid off more and more staff, they have forced workers to regularly work 80 to 90 hours a week, leading to an exodus of staff. Conductors and engineers say that they can be on call for 14 consecutive days, no weekends off, and are expected to drop everything at any time of day to go to work. They say the policy is, quote, destroying their lives, as the Washington Post reports it. Dennis Pierce, president of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, told the paper, quote, all we're asking is folks to be able to go to routine doctor's visits without pay, but they have refused to accept our proposals. The average American would not know that we get fired for going to the doctor. This one thing has our members most enraged. We have guys who were punished for taking time off for a heart attack and for COVID. It's inhumane, he said. To give you just a little bit more of a sense of that, here is David Manning, a railroad worker today on, of all places, the far-right Newsmax outlet.
David, we did reach out to the Association of American Railroads, and they say that workers get sick days and paid time off. But what I want to talk to you about is, what does this mean for Americans if you do go on strike?
Well, whoever told you we get sick days is manipulating the data. We get paid time off that we earned the previous year before. Before the new policy came about, we were allowed to take 5 days off and 2 weekend days off a month. Now we could take virtually 1 day unpaid off a month. And then the only other time we could take off is our paid time that we had to earn the previous year.
Yeah, that does seem ridiculous. They would never let airline pilots do that. Is that issue number one for members of the
unions? 100% is number one. And if we go on strike, yes, it could hurt the economy. It could be bad for society, but we don't want to do that. None of us want to do that.
Well, and I know Amtrak's already suspended.
We're not asking for the world here. We're asking for a few days off a month to spend with our family instead of living on a train. We spend 240 to 260 hours a month sitting on these trains or sitting at the hotel rooms away from our families.
That's wow.
When I leave my house to go to work, I'm gone for at least 2 to 2.5 to 3 days.
I didn't come realize home, that, David.
I come home and I'm only allowed to be home for 10 hours.
Wow.
And then I can be called to go right back to be gone
and,
for 3 days.
You have a family?
Yes.
Kids?
My kid is 17 years old.
Wow.
Wow, indeed.
Yeah, and for Newsmax to finally have it dawn on them that, hey, maybe this isn't good for some workers.
Well, actually, I was kind of stunned to hear that on Newsmax, of all places.
Too.
And then I realized, oh, yeah, Warren Buffett controls the huge rail company BNSF, and right-wingers hate Warren Buffett. So maybe they'll accidentally be on the right side of this issue and stand up for labor for a change, because it allows them to oppose Buffett. If so, I'll take it. Thanks, Newsmax. But also, no doubt, is because a rail strike would come at a terrible time for the Biden administration just, you know, weeks before the midterms. So far, the rail operators have not budged on these union demands for a policy addressing their concerns. A federal mandated cooling off period now ends on Friday at, you know, 12:01. Which opens the possibility of a strike by the weekend, and as noted, what appears to be lockouts even before then. For decades, many railroad workers have been forced to put up with this chaotic lifestyle because the Railway Labor Act actually gives the power to Congress to block any strike by workers. And time and again, when workers have moved to strike, Congress has stepped in to block them in the name of ensuring the free movement of commerce across the country. What happens this time right now is anyone's guess. As noted, the timing could not be worse. We will, of course, keep our eyes on that, but for some better labor news today, and yes, there is some, here in California, for more than 500,000 fast food workers. So let's take a quick break here. We'll be joined by the American Prospect's Harold Meyerson on a new measure just signed into law by California's Governor Gavin Newsom that Meyerson lauds as an achievement by labor unions in the Golden State that has succeeded, quote, beyond anyone's wildest expectations. That sounds good. That's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I know you're tired, I know you're hurting, I know you broke down to the bone. But your bills are paid and the smiling faces waiting on you at home. And it ain't always easy, it ain't ever like you planned. All but man, ain't it working, working man.
Working woman, too. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Last week, just after our Labor Day break, we noted new polling finding that public approval among Americans for labor unions was at 71%. That is the highest level of support for unions in nearly 60 years, since 1965, according to Gallup's annual pre-Labor Day survey, which they have been carrying out since the 1930s, when support for unions at the time in 1936 was 72%, just 1 point higher than it is today in 2022. Paradoxically, however, as progressive author and lecturer Deepak Bhargava recently observed in his email newsletter, only 6% of workers are in private sector unions, the lowest share in a century. The decades-long movement from the right to crush private and public labor unions has been an effective one. But progressives are finally finding new ways to push back, forming new labor unions at massive private companies like Amazon and Starbucks. And progressive politicians are also realizing that that support for labor is, in fact, a very popular idea. On Labor Day, California's Governor Gavin Newsom announced via a video posted to Twitter that he had signed landmark legislation in the state to empower fast food workers with new wage and workplace protections to support their health, safety, and welfare.
Well, happy Labor Day, everybody. And I think one of the things that makes California a special place, by definition, is we're the fifth largest economy in the world. But that didn't happen by chance. We've long had a formula for success around growth and inclusion. So many states forget the latter part of that formula. But I'm really proud of California, and I'm proud of the men and women of organized labor, particularly on Labor Day, for their extraordinary work over the course of decades to empower workers, to give them voice and choice, and to fight not just for wages, but better working conditions. Same time, we've got work to do. At the same time, we recognize there are sectors of our economy where we're falling a bit short. And one of those areas is fast food workers. And I want to thank Assemblymember Holden in particular for AB 257 and all of his hard work, a bill that empowers our workers, particularly in that sector, giving them more voice, giving them more choice, creating a new council. And I'm proud on Labor Day to sign that bill and to shrine it in law.
In a press release from the governor's office announcing the signing of that bill, AB 257, Newsom noted, quote, California is committed to ensuring that the men and women who have helped build our world-class economy are able to share in the state's prosperity. Today's action, he said, gives hardworking fast food workers a stronger voice and seat at the table to set fair wages and critical health and safety standards across the country. In recent years, as you may know, fast food workers around the nation have been pushing to unionize workers while demanding a $15 national minimum wage. Just after the California State Senate and Assembly had both approved AB 257 in late August, and as we were waiting to see if the state's Democratic governor, Governor Newsom, who clearly now has presidential ambitions of his own, waiting to see if he would sign this new bill into law, the great Harold Meyerson at the American Prospect explained, Plan A, when the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, began its fight for $15 and a union for fast food workers a decade ago, was, well, to unionize fast food workers and win them a livable hourly wage of $15. At the time, the canniest union strategist I knew told me that unionizing fast food workers was a pipe dream, that there were far too many outlets owned by far too many franchisees who effectively shielded such corporate behemoths as McDonald's from the threat of a unionized workforce. Classic unionization studies in the mid-20th century by academics, Meyerson explained, demonstrated that the only cost-efficient organizing campaigns focused on massive workplaces. Going Taco Bell by Taco Bell, he said, would never really work, though Starbucks, to be sure, may prove the exception to this rule, Meyerson explains. Today, 10 years after Mary Kay Henry, the president of SEIU, committed to the $15 and a union campaign, the union still, 10 years later, can't claim any fast food workers as dues-paying members. More than 1,000 Starbucks baristas have voted to join, but they are not members until they have a contract. But a Plan B fallback has succeeded, writes Meyerson, beyond anyone's wildest expectations. What is Plan B in this case? Well, part of that just came to fruition in the state of California with the signature of the governor on Labor Day. Joining us now to explain is Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large of the American Prospect magazine, where he has served since 2001, as he also for many years served as a weekly columnist for the Washington Post, executive editor for the LA Weekly, and still contributes to the Los Angeles Times and other publications. Oh, Mr. Meyerson, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Always good to be here, Brad.
So if, Harold, the SEIU's Plan A was to fight for store-by-store unionization of fast food workers to demand $15 minimum wage, what was Plan B? Because as you describe it, frankly, Plan B, the fallback plan here, as you call it, and sort of built into the fabric of this new California law affecting more than 500,000 fast food workers in California, it actually sounds like an arguably better plan in many respects than Plan A.
It sort of is. But I would call what Gavin Newsom signed into law on Labor Day really Plan C.
Okay.
Plan B, remember it was $15 in a union, and mm-hmm. it was really this campaign which led to first a handful of cities like Seattle and then San Francisco and L.A. Mm-hmm. to raise their own minimum wage to $15, and then a number of states, I think 8 states, have followed through on that, including California and New York, mm-hmm. and with some cost of living increases built in, so that the minimum wage in California now, I think, is $15.50. So that was Plan B. What Gavin Newsom signed into law, I would almost call Plan C. That is, given that states and cities have no jurisdiction, have no control over unionization, that is preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the National Labor Relations Act, though it worked beautifully for about its first 10 years from 1935 through shortly after World War II to do what it was intended to do, which is to give workers a chance to unionize and collectively bargain, mm-hmm. has now been weakened over the subsequent 70 years by court decisions and other matters, sort of scaling down what it could do to protect workers, and by the vehement resistance of almost universally employers across the country. So that actually unionizing workers has proved so difficult that, as you said right at the outset, only 6% of private sector workers actually are union members, mm-hmm. whereas right after World War II, it was over a third of the entire nation's workforce. So that's a big change. So what the bill that Gavin Newsom signed does, and it's really groundbreaking, there's been nothing like it really in American history, is it sets up what's called sectoral bargaining, where in which representatives of workers in an entire industry sit down with representatives of management in the industry, and in this case with a couple of state officials as well, and they set standards for the industry. The workers don't come out of this as members of SEIU or any other union. What they do come out of it with is a process, a group of 10, four worker representatives, including two workers themselves, four management representatives, and the governor's, the head of the governor's labor department and finance department, I think, to craft wage and benefit and workplace safety and other standards for every worker in a chain fast food outlet in California that has at least 100 outlets nationwide. So, you know, McDonald's, Jack in the Box, Starbucks, you name it. Sectoral bargaining is actually fairly common in Western Europe. But there it evolved on top of, you know, a much higher level of unionization of their workers than we have here in the United States. And we have had kind of privately worked out versions of sectoral bargaining in this country. In the old days when there were really just three auto companies and one hugely powerful union at the time, the United Auto Workers, the UAW would, you know, strike and get a contract with one of the big three, and then that would be viewed as the contract the other two, say you strike General Motors, you get a contract, then Ford and Chrysler sign essentially the same contract. That was called pattern bargaining. This is bargaining in which not necessarily preceded by a strike, though it's certainly preceded by a level of union activism, otherwise Newsom wouldn't have signed the bill. That was part pattern bargaining, but the government didn't really play a role. This is the first time the government has, you know, passed a law that sets up the what is sectoral bargaining for the whole sector. It's really, you know, quite groundbreaking. It's a first in American labor relations, and it's been a long time since there's been a pro-worker first. In American labor relations.
Yeah,
many decades.
You describe it as something new under the American sun in your article at the Prospect. But you also note there has been some sort of sectoral bargaining of a sort. You describe the Depression era Congress in 1935, the Motor Carrier Act, which set a floor beneath which interstate trucking companies could not lower their rates. Was that able to be done at the federal level? How is that different? And was that able to be done at the federal level because of the interstate nature of the trucking business? And would that otherwise?
This actually goes back. Actually goes back to railroad law. There had been a Railway Act passed well before the New Deal that regulated railroad rates in part to keep competition from running amok. I mean, if there was ever an industry preyed to bankruptcy in the 19th century, it was railroads. They started up, they failed. The pre-New Deal Congresses didn't want that to happen, so they sort of set rate regulation. Well, by the mid-1930s, interstate trucking was relatively new, but it was clearly going to be, you know, they could see it was going to be as big a deal eventually, if not bigger, than rail. And so they passed a law that said, you know, to get approval for interstate trucking. And since it's interstate, it had to be at the national level, obviously. This was about long-haul trucking, which, as I said, was a new industry at that point. You know, you had to agree not to cut your rates below a certain level. And this was also part of, you know, depression legislation because, you know, there was no, with incredible high levels of unemployment, there was no spending, wages had been cut everywhere, and the economy was in a downward spiral that only federal standards and federal intervention and direct federal employment could reverse. And so this also ensured that, you know, a new company not only could, you know, enter the market with really cheap rates, but that that wouldn't be the cause of truck workers having to work for essentially nothing.
So
that there was there wasn't really, you know, this wasn't related to unionizing long-haul truckers. The first attempt to do that, and it wasn't really long-haul truckers, it was just truckers who drove across city lines, had been a strike in Minneapolis in 1934, parentheses, the only labor action in American history that was actually led by Trotskyists.
I thought they all were, but okay, go ahead. That's what I was told.
There were never that many Trotskyists.
Okay. Who knew? Well, but Harold. Go ahead.
One of the people who worked on that strike was a very young Teamster named Jimmy Hoffa, and he understood that by trying to shut in, not to try to unionize just one company, but the whole that the only way truckers could win was to really shut down the entire Twin City trucking industry. And when he gained more power in the Teamsters, and that was decades later, he, you know, managed to get first statewide contracts. And then in 1965, which is 30 years after the Motor Carrier Act was passed, he crafted the Interstate Master Freight Agreement, which 800 companies signed on to, and which essentially unionized 450,000 Teamsters. And this was hailed at the time, the New York Times editorial saying this is something, then they said this is something basic, that if they had written in my voice, they they would have said something new under the American sun.
Indeed.
But it took 30 years. In this case, you know, we don't know when workers in fast food outlets will actually be union members, but we know that they're getting some of the benefits that come with union membership, even though they're not union members, through the act that Gavin Newsom signed.
Well, let's talk about that. And actually, I just want to note, as I was looking at this, that Depression-era 1935 Motor Carrier Act, that was, it was 1936 when union support, according to Gallup, was 72%. Now it's 71%. I don't know if these things work hand in hand or not. But
I wish they did.
It is interesting to note. And as noted, a plan B, or as you now describe it, plan C, actually sounds like a better plan to sort of deal with all of the shops across, in one sense, you know, across all a particular sector, in this case, the fast food sector, with its huge number of workers, and now supported in one sense by the state itself. That almost sounds like a better plan than a store-by-store unionization plan. What are the downsides of what Newsom has now signed into law, which essentially sets up a 10-person council of managed franchise owners, two people from the corporate chains, two fast food workers, two advocates likely from SEIU, and two who are the governor's appointees to sort of work together. What are the downsides of this plan that concern you?
Well, there are a couple. One is this doesn't, in a certain sense, obviate the need for a union. I mean, had SEIU not already been a hugely powerful union in California, and in California, SEIU has 700,000 members.
Yeah.
That's clout.
Right.
You know, the only comparably powerful union, I think, in California is the California Teachers Association.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they have just about half the number of members in California that SEIU has. So that's real clout. And if, you know, unions don't grow, you know, they're not going to have the kind of clout required to get this kind of legislation through. So that's point one. Point mm-hmm. two is that it's always possible that workers seeing the benefits coming from this particular act will think that the need to unionize is, you know, isn't really there.
Mm.
Now, there's a caveat to that, and this has not been widely reported, but the bill creates a possible opt-out, which is if a franchise or a company agrees to let its workers, you know, join unions by, say, car check, or anyway, the company will remain neutral.
Mm-hmm.
They are then relieved from some of the things that this Council of Ten can mandate.
Mm.
Of course, in a union contract, they'll probably get those anyway, but that kind of gives SEIU a clear interest in the bill as one possible almost sort of back doorway of actually gaining members. And then the third problem with the bill isn't with the bill. It's that it's creating a totally anticipatable backlash
mm-hmm.
among the McDonald's and Jack in the Boxes of this world
mm-hmm.
and many franchise owners who, less than 24 hours after Newsom signed the bill, said they were going to put an initiative, a referendum,
mm-hmm.
on the 2024 ballot to convince voters to, you know,
mm-hmm.
negate the law, to repeal it, in essence. So, California already went through a ballot measure put on the ballot by Uber and Lyft and such
mm-hmm.
To strike down a law which was passed to give more income and rights to gig workers like
right.
drivers for
mm-hmm.
Uber and Lyft and so on. And those companies spent a gazillion dollars and persuaded voters who were really kind of confused by the measure anyway to strike down that law.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see a similar campaign, absolutely, assuming that they can collect enough signatures by the end of the year to put this on the 2024 ballot. So we're going to see that coming at California voters, unfortunately, fairly, you know, in 2 years' time.
Well, there's also another side of that, Harold Meyerson, which is that, you know, along with setting up a 10-member council, it also sets a minimum hourly wage for the 500,000 workers in the sector at $22 an hour, stipulates that wage will be adjusted annually in accordance with consumer price index. And one of the reasons that we've been told around the country that fast food workers were not even worth a $15 minimum wage is because such a mandate would raise prices of fast food. It would put franchisees out of business. Well, we'll have another year or two under this new law. If the stores do not shut down or go out of business in the wake of this new measure, you know, because prices are raised just so much that, you know, nobody goes there anymore. Well, isn't it arguable that California's experiment here could serve as a helpful example for workers and progressive politicians in other states if the world doesn't collapse in the wake of this law?
It could, but two caveats here. First
yeah.
of all, if I think the franchise industry has until some point in late November or early December to collect the required number of, you know, validatable signatures
mm-hmm.
To put this on the 2024 ballot. If they do, then the law doesn't go into effect until after that 2024 vote. So that is a big problem. If
okay.
they fail to come. If they fail to collect the signatures, then the law goes into effect. They can always then put an initiative on the ballot, but at that point they would be effectively demanding a wage cut for 500,000 workers and their families
right.
and et cetera, and that would be, that would be harder for them to get voters to go for.
So their race is on.
It's a real question. Then also, you know, look, we don't know if the price of food generally, which has been obviously, rising significantly over the last year, we don't know if that's going to be the case in 2024. And that will have, I think, some effect on the vote then. If food is viewed as, increasingly costly and continues to be, by then that too would make it easier for the industry to win that vote. Mm-hmm.
And you can always blame it on Gavin Newsom and those Trotskyite Democrats in California.
Right. Right,
Now, the and by the way, I should note there's also, as you note, the math of this, the way this 10-member state mandated council is set up, it actually could be swung in favor of business and management in the event that a Republican gubernatorial administration takes over. No.
Yeah, but I think at this point the chances of Republicans winning the governorship and other statewide offices is, to get back to our metaphor of this conversation, is about the same as the Trotskyists winning in California. California, beyond all the demographic changes and everything else that has shifted California well to the left, Republicans in the state have also done a spectacular job of marginalizing themselves. So, maybe 40 years from now, or 30 years from now, Republicans, whatever they consist of, could win, but not in the foreseeable future.
I got two questions to ask you real quickly before we get out, Harold. Fighting for workers, has always seemed like a no-brainer to me. There's more workers than business owners, etc., which means there's more voters to seemingly support pro-worker politicians. And yet the anti-union forces in this country have been wildly successful in recent decades. To what do you attribute this enormous chasm between the real support for the American people by the American people for labor unions, as noted in that Gallup study, and the number of unions and unionized workers that seem to be shrinking, or that at least have been, particularly in the private sector, in recent decades?
Well, I attribute it to the fact that labor law has been so eroded that management can break the labor law by firing organizers and firing union activists during organizing drives. Mm. And face no real penalties. It takes years to adjudicate. It has taken years to adjudicate those kinds of violations. Mm-hmm. And even if the employer is found guilty, all that employer has to do is rehire the fired worker. Mm-hmm. This could be years after the organizing drive has failed. Mm-hmm. Pay the worker's back pay, unless the worker has since gotten another job, which if he has, that's subtracted from what the employer owes, and the employer has to post a notice somewhere in the workplace that this has happened. So effectively, that's no penalty at all.
Right.
Now, Biden has appointed some terrific pro-labor people to key positions, mm-hmm. most especially Jennifer Abruzzo to be the general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board. And she's, taking labor law back to the way it was under Harry Truman, so that, among other things, if a worker is fired and during an organizing drive, as was the case in the successful organizing drive for the Amazon warehouse in Staten Island, she said that it's a violation in real time, and the worker gets to be reinstated right then, which hasn't been really the standard in labor law for 70 years.
Mm.
So within the administration, there are, there are people trying to restore labor law as best they can, but it really requires congressional legislation, and there's something called the PRO Act, which has passed the House, but of course it's not passed the Senate, which would, really bolster, eliminate all the holes in labor law that right-wing judges and employers influencing right-wing judges have put there over the last several generations. There's clearly a popular pro-union majority in the nation, but it's not reflected in the composition and beliefs of the folks who sit on the federal courts.
Maybe we can begin to change that between now and November. Harold, last time that you were on with us, it was way back in January. I look back, and it looks like it was just after Joe Manchin had finally killed Joe Biden's Build Back Better Act in the Senate, and seemingly Biden and the Democrats' domestic agenda along with it. At the time, you described Omicron, inflation, Manchin, and Kyrsten Sinema as the four horsemen of Democratic decline. And you said, you suggested that passing a scaled back Build Back Better bill would certainly help extricate the Democrats from the problems they were facing at that point. Well, what do you know? They must be reading the prospect, because that is exactly what they ended up doing with the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. So, Harold Meyerson, will that help? What kind of difference is the IRA likely to have on the upcoming midterms just under 8 weeks from today?
Sure, it'll help. In conjunction with the CHIPS Act, and the Infrastructure Act, and the reduction of at least a fraction of student debt. All of that, no one is saying Joe Biden is a do-nothing president at this point, or mm-hmm. even that this is a do-nothing Congress. So all of that helps, but the fact that, judges are in a different place from the rest of the country on labor, well, they were in a different place from the rest of the country on abortion, and mm-hmm. that's really the one thing that gives the Democrats a fighting chance in November. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to see how that comes out.
Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large of the American Prospect, which you can and should read at prospect.org. You can also find him on Twitter at Harold Meyerson. Harold, always great catching up with you, sir. I look forward to doing it maybe not quite as many months as it was the last time. Thanks, Harold.
Thank you, Brad.
You bet. Okay, we have got to get out. Thank you very much.
Yes, indeed.
Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. Of course, thanks to Harold and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. We greatly appreciate it. It's always an honor. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it for free anytime at bradblog.com, where you can also share it with your friends and your family and your coworkers and your enemies. That is all thanks to those of you who drop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, you will find me at TheBradBlog. I will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.